Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Hello and good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see so many people here on this fine Friday afternoon. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to come.
So we have off today. Today we actually have a basket donated from Ready Harvest. So we have a few minutes to run to the front table and grab a raffle ticket. We'll pass our guest speaker, the Holy Monkey winner, in just a few moments, but we pass the tickets available for a basket donated by Great Lakes. If you take a moment to please turn off your cell phones. So for our radio listeners, if you please keep your
headphones turned off or on vibrate. Speaking of the radio, I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording, and he's given me the thumbs up on everything's go. If you want to listen to this program or any of our other previous programs, you can listen to it on the radio or go to their website, alaskapublic.org, and search for AWAC Presents, and you'll find Kathy Calvin as well as some of our other speakers there. We are a membership organization, and memberships will be expiring at the end of June, but we have a special for those of you who are currently not a member. If you sign up for membership today, your membership will be good for the rest of this year and all of next year. So please consider joining and supporting this organization. And it is too late to apply for your PFDs, but it is not too late to designate charitable organizations under the Pick, Click, and Give program. You can do that designation up through August. So while you're online, please consider thinking of the Alaska World Affairs Council as part of the Pick, Click, Give program through your PFDs. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council program, if you could please raise your hand. Do we have any newcomers? Ah, welcome. Fabulous. Great to see all of you. And I hope you come again. Next week, we have the last of our oil and gas series speaker, a gentleman named Mr. Ed Chow, talking about the international petroleum landscape. This is expected to be a great program, so please consider coming back again next week. If you're a student, if you wouldn't mind standing up and being recognized, I realize this is finals week, but do we have any students who have come? Aha! Fantastic. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student programs and allowing students to come every week to the Alaska World Affairs Council. Before I introduce the head table, I'd like to ask Kari to come up with our raffle tickets for this great, great harvest breadbasket assortment. Kathy, if you wouldn't mind picking the lucky winner. I see there's red tickets and blue tickets today. She picked a blue ticket. So if you have a blue ticket and your number is 584-278, 584-278, yeah, well, there you go. Congratulations. You wonderful, great basket. And now for our head table, to my far left is Ms. Cheryl Myers, who is the chair of our board development committee and has been very busy this year and done fabulous things with our organization. Thank you very much for joining us and sitting at the head table, Cheryl. And to her right is Mr. Garrett Wong, who will be coming to the podium. And Garrett is the chair of our board of directors, and he will introduce our speaker, Garrett.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you today Kathy Calvin. You know, Kathy is the Chief Executive Officer of the United Nations Foundation. The UN Foundation was created in 1998 with Ted Turner's historic $1 billion gift to support UN causes and activities. The UN Foundation advocates for the UN. It connects people, ideas, and resources to help the United Nations solve global problems. As a public charity with many other partners, the UN Foundation's work is focused on decreasing child mortality, empowering women and girls, creating a clean energy future, using mobile technology for development, and improving US-UN relations. Prior to joining the UN Foundation, in 2003, Kathy served as the president of the AOL Time Warner Foundation. And immediately prior to joining AOL, she was a senior managing director at Hill & Knowlton, a global public relations company. For 12 years before that, she was the director of the editorial administration for U.S. News and World Report. Kathy is here today to speak to us on Alaska and the UN, more connected now than you know. So please help me in welcoming Kathy Calvin to the podium.
Thank you, Garrett. Thank you, Kari. And welcome, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. This is my first trip not only to Alaska, but to Anchorage. And I was just spending 3 days in Juneau with my husband, John. And we spoke there at the Juneau World Affairs Council and actually saw some sun yesterday morning as we left. And we're flying up here to Anchorage. And it's been so educational to spend some time here. Nancy took us on a tour of the Alaska Museum yesterday, and you all know what a great docent she is. So we got a good education on the four tribal groups and the history and the future, and really got a beginning of an understanding of Alaska, but have much more to learn. I'm really grateful to be here to two people who aren't here today. One is Alice Rogoff, who I'm sure all of you know from her work with this organization and her passion for Alaska. Alice and I worked together nearly 25 years ago when we were both at U.S. News and World Report. She had a phenomenal career in Washington at the Washington Post and for the Carter administration, and I've never seen her as passionate and as excited about her work as she is now in what she's doing with the Alaskan Dispatch. So it's great, and I'm grateful that she's giving me the opportunity to come up here and see what she's doing and to meet all of you. And the other person who was inspirational in getting me here is Pat Yak, who came up here as a journalist and who I worked with in the Gary Hart campaign many, many years ago. And so he's been bragging on his experience here and saying how great it is. And of course, Lisa's been terrific at making this whole thing come together. So it's wonderful to be here. So I know it's a gorgeous day and I'm standing between you and kayaking or hiking or whatever else. So I'm going to just jump right in. And I hope to make this as much a conversation as a presentation, because I'd love to hear what's on your minds. I expect to hear questions from some of you students as well. And I'm here because I'm passionate about the UN. You know, I didn't know when I was a child in Ohio and carrying around my orange and black UNICEF box on Halloween nights, that I would someday be working with that institution that seems so big and so far away, but I thought was probably doing some really good things for children around the world. Since then, I've obviously learned a lot about it. One other job that I'm realizing sort of fell off my resume or bio was that I worked at AOL for 7 years in the heyday of its expansion in taking the world from one form of communication to an incredibly new form of communication. And that experience, I think, really opened my eyes to the fact that the world is no longer wherever we are living. It is truly a global experience that we're all part of, whether it's in the work we do or the things we buy or the things we read. We are all global citizens. And so one of the things I want to talk about today is how the UN is actually closer to you, and maybe even closer to you here in Alaska, than many other citizens in the rest of the United States, in the work that it's doing and in the impact that it's having on your lives. Before I get to the three key things I want to talk about in that regard, I just want to tell you a little bit about the UN Foundation, and I'll come back to it at the end and tell you some of the things we're doing that, frankly, I would love to interest some of you in joining us on. As Garrett said, we do try to make the foundation an opportunity for companies, foundations, individuals, and others to work together on some of the bigger global issues that may be of interest to you, whether it be global health, clean energy, saving children's lives, women's rights, etc. So as Garrett mentioned, the foundation was created by Ted Turner in 1998. And at that time, he had already experienced global celebrity and fame in that he had created CNN in 1980 and also had created the Goodwill Games, which I think up here you all were very aware of. I understand there may be some Goodwill Games taking place here in Alaska this year, perhaps. And so Ted's vision was that not only had CNN brought the world closer together as he created a 24-hour global information network, but he put bureaus heroes around the world in places that, frankly, Americans weren't aware of what was happening. And he was instrumental in coverage of things like the fall of the Berlin Wall or famines that were taking place in Africa. And through all of that, he became even more aware of the importance of the UN, not only in terms of those humanitarian work, the humanitarian work that the UN was doing, but also its forum as the one place where countries could come together and peaceably work out their differences through the Security Council and the General Assembly. So when he was being honored in late 1997, just going into 98, by the UN Association, which is an organization very similar to the World Affairs Council. It brings Americans together to talk about, learn about, and help support and advocate for U.S. leadership on global issues. He was being honored by the UN Association in New York, and he decided he should do something kind of special with it, with his speech, and he decided he would give $1 billion to support the UN. I mean, I'm not doing that today myself, but I can imagine what it was like to be in the audience that night when your speaker says he's going to give $1 billion to support the UN. You can also imagine what it must have been like to be the Secretary General of the United Nations when Ted went in to speak to him, Kofi Annan, who was the previous Secretary General, and said, you know, I'm planning to make this gift, and it's a significant portion of my net worth, and I can't think of a better thing that I'd rather do with it. And in doing so, I think Ted did two things. He kicked off what is now a new era of remarkable, audacious philanthropy. We've now seen Warren Buffett and George Soros and, of course, Bill and Melinda Gates all stepping up and doing truly remarkable philanthropy that affects people around the world. A lot of people have always done good philanthropy for their own communities, for their colleges, for their local hospitals. This is just taking it to another level. And so we've seen some remarkable philanthropists step up in the last few years, I think inspired by Ted's original vision and decision to be a big philanthropist. And second, he did something that was also, I think, pretty unusual in that in creating the foundation that would support the UN, he didn't put his own name on it. And in fact, the UN let him put their name on it, which was pretty amazing in and of itself. You don't give your name away easily. Coca-Cola doesn't just give you the name Coca-Cola because maybe you're going to do something good for them. But the UN felt that Ted was about to change the nature of public-private partnerships by standing up for the UN and inviting others to join him. So we do carry the name the UN Foundation. We do three things. We help lobby for the UN in the United States to make sure that the dues in our peacekeeping assessment is paid on time, in full, and without restrictions every year. And we've been doing pretty well on that in the last few years. We also create large-scale public-private partnerships to support UN causes. So we partner with organizations ranging from the Gates Foundation to ExxonMobil to the Vodafone Corporation, with organizations that want to work on big global issues and know that you can get more done usually at scale by partnering with others. And we run campaigns that allow individuals, even students, to get involved in some big issues such as educating adolescent girls or preventing malaria around the world or making sure that young children have access to vaccines. And I'm going to talk about those campaigns at the end. But the real thing I want to talk about today is to start with why the UN. And I appreciate that people came out today. Sometimes I feel like people say, well, the UN, it's just so far away and it doesn't relate. And in fact, there's a vast middle ground of people who I think understand it's not at either extreme of our politics. I'm not the person who's saying, gee, the UN is the only hope for the world. And I'm not the person over on this side who's saying, you know, the UN is the end of the world. But there's a true value for the UN that's right in the middle. And it's something that I think those of you who've watched the UN over the years probably can relate to. I also believe that constructive participation in the UN by the U.S. and by American citizens and by our leaders is critical and has real consequences for us on policy issues, on economic issues, and on the way we participate in the rest of the world. To quote Susan Rice, who's the U.S. ambassador to the UN, the UN's investment in our common humanity turns out to be also a real investment in our common security. So I want to touch on three areas where I think that's really important and that may make some resonance with you here in Alaska today. The first is how the U.S. contribution to the UN pays off in many ways, particularly for U.S. companies through the UN's presence in the United States. The second is in the realm of energy, and I think I'm speaking to the right audience about that, oil, gas, and renewable energy. And the third is something called the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which has real consequences for Alaska, and I'm seeing a few heads nodding. I got a lot of tutorial on this when I was in Juneau from some of your colleagues there, and I'm going to start with that because I think it's the most important thing to begin with because it's so relevant here. So I think some of you must know about this treaty, but in case you're not familiar with it, it was a treaty that was negotiated in 1992. Bill Clinton was in office. The president of the UN Foundation, Senator Timothy Wirth, actually was at the State Department and was very involved in it. It's a comprehensive framework for managing the world's oceans and the relations of coastal states. Every Arctic nation in the world, except this country, which is, of course, an Arctic nation because Alaska is our Arctic state, has ratified the treaty. The U.S. has not. It's a crime that it hasn't, and it's not helping us, and in fact, it's hurting us a lot. Because the treaty, you know, I think you probably know its functions. It defines maritime zones, it protects the maritime environment, it preserves freedom of navigation, it allocates rights to resources, and it establishes guidelines for businesses that are doing work and fishing along the coast. So given those broad range of interests, you want to say, why hasn't the U.S. ratified it? Well, you know, there's opposition from a few senators, and I'm telling you, it's a few senators in the lower 48 and in the Senate who feel that this is a loss of U.S. sovereignty, meaning that there are rules being applied to the U.S. by the U.N. Well, that's just not true. First of all, the U.N. doesn't have any oversight of this convention. This is a convention that was signed by a number of nations and puts the work into an organization that will help it work. It's supported by a wide array of groups, including some that rarely see eye to eye on politics in general. So it ranges from every living former president, the Chamber of Commerce, the International Association of Drilling Contractors, the American Petroleum Institute, the National Fisheries Institute, as well as a host of environmental organizations. So it's not one or the other. It's not business, it's not environment. This is something that's truly for both. And of course, you know, the Alaska delegation has been phenomenal in its strong, vocal, and vociferous support for this thing. You know, both parties and both senators have been really strong on supporting it and pushing for a ratification discussion in the Senate. So there's some good news in that I think your delegation has been successful in getting this issue raised to the top of the attention span in Washington. The Obama administration has said that of all the treaties, and there are a number of treaties that have been created at the UN that the U.S. still has not ratified. Another one that I care deeply about is the Convention on Rights for Women. We still haven't done that. The Convention on Rights for the Child has still not been ratified by the U.S. But the one that the U.S. Now is saying is the most important to be addressed and will be taken up first is the Law of the Sea. I don't think we'll get a vote in this calendar year. It's an election year. You know, it's tricky to get anything done in these last few months before an election. That said, Senator Kerry and Senator Lugar have committed to holding hearings in May or June. There's going to be one on national security issues, and the Coast Guard will be testifying. There's going to be one on economic interests, and the Chamber of Commerce will be testifying. This is an opportunity for all of you to reach out to not just our own delegation here in Alaska, but to any members of Congress that with which you have the ability to have influence. I'm hoping World Affairs Councils across the country are actually putting this on their agenda because it's a really important issue for us right now. And I wanted to make sure you know that there is a lot of attention on this happening right now in Washington, and we're really really trying hard to make sure something happens. We know that Alaska will benefit greatly if it's ratified. We know that other countries are already acting as if it has been put into place. They're beginning to take steps to expand their own territorial presence. Alaska will benefit by an increase of something like two Californias with an extension into the coastal range. So I think we really need to keep our eye on this ball and make sure that we make some progress on it very soon. Of course, the Law of the Sea is only one thing that's related to Alaska's interest in energy and natural resources, and the other is how we are moving forward toward a clean energy future. This is an area that the UN, frankly, has never had much to say about. Both the U.S., Russia, and the Middle Eastern countries have always said this is hands-off territory for the United Nations. These are, talk about sovereign issues, these are issues nobody wants the UN to be getting near. That said, this Secretary General, who's from Korea, felt strongly that if the UN didn't begin to create a common ground for conversations to take place around energy, for committing to ensuring that every nation around the world had access to clean and affordable energy, he would have missed a real opportunity with his two terms as Secretary General. As he came into office 5 years ago, we were negotiating a climate treaty. We've not gotten that done yet, as you know, but he committed a fair amount of his political capital to getting there. In the process of that, he began to realize that a climate treaty was really dependent on an aggressive, future-oriented, and smart energy policy, and that it was a building block toward getting to a reduction in carbon emissions. So this year, he has initiated a plan called Sustainable Energy for All, and it addresses the fact that one out of five people on the planet lacks access to modern energy supplies, specifically electricity. Two out of five people around the globe use clean or use dirty and inefficient energy. And it's holding back the rest of the world in terms of everything from poverty elimination to financial growth to health and prosperity. So he's urged the countries of the world to join him in a goal for 2030. That sounds a long way off, but you know, if you don't start something now, you don't even get to 2030. So the Sustainable Energy for All initiative has three goals. The first is energy access for everyone, so total universal energy access by 2030. A doubling of the use of renewable energy by 2030, and a doubling of energy efficiency. So, you know, there's something here for all nations. So, obviously, in this country, we could be doing much more with renewables, we could be doing much more with gas, we could be doing much more with energy conservation and smart reduction of energy use. In developing nations, they use too much dangerous cooking fuels, using black dung for cooking, it's killing their women, it's killing their children. It's killing the environment, so we need to get cleaner fuels into those countries. We need companies and corporations to step up. This is not an area where governments alone are going to be able to solve the problem. There just isn't enough money, but this is an area where we know that there could be genuine public-private partnerships where companies are investing in that infrastructure. There's a place for civil society, there's a place for academia, and there's a place for foundations and philanthropy. So this is genuine, I think, a pretty exciting area for the future where we know that there's a goal that needs to be met. When the conference that is taking place in Rio de Janeiro in June, the Rio Earth Summit, I think some of you may be aware of this, this is a summit that's taking place 20 years after the original Earth Summit in Rio. When it takes place in June, we are hopeful that there will be a global agreement on getting to a vision and a plan for a clean energy future that all countries can be part of, that all countries can lead in, and that all countries can be proud of. I think it's exciting that the UN is leading on this area and providing opportunities for everyone to be part of this. There's also a final piece I wanted to touch on having to do with the UN and how it affects you. And that's U.S. business interests. And sometimes we don't think about the UN and business. They seem like pretty far apart. In fact, for many, many years, the UN was just something for member states. It was an organization of nations. It started with 50 nations. There are now 192. And you sometimes wonder why it's so hard to get things done. Well, it's pretty hard to get things done when you have 192 members all wanting to have a say. But we are seeing some really good impacts on the U.S. right now from the UN. The U.S. pays roughly one-tenth of 1% of 1 cent of our tax dollar goes to the UN. It's a small amount. And for every dollar in support that we give the UN, we get about $1.46 back. That was surprising to me when I learned it. I didn't really know. A big part of it is that the UN has a large presence in the United States, and U.S. contractors, of course, benefit from everything that the UN does in the United States. But it's not just that. It's that we benefit from the fact that we purchase goods and services from over 3,500 businesses, including Alaska companies, across the United States. Procurement goes to everything from Ford to Trek to Caterpillar to Cisco. We do for work ranging on vehicles to food to technology services. But most important, the UN makes investments, I think, as I mentioned earlier, in our global security because we make investments in global humanity. And I want to talk to you a little bit about where that one-tenth of 1 cent of our tax dollar goes and what you get for it, because it's pretty significant. In one day, the UN is doing stuff for the world that I think should make all of us proud. And what you get for that money is that the UN is working to create peace around the world. We fund, through the UN, 130,000 peacekeepers who are in 14 missions in the scariest and most broken places in the world. Now, the U.S. itself doesn't send peacekeepers. We have about 87 U.S. military people right now in Uganda, but that's not the way we support peacekeeping. We support it through a financial contribution. Other countries like India, Nepal, Japan provide the peacekeepers that allow the American forces not to go in and be the police to the whole world. Our ambassador, Susan Rice, has made the point over and over that the U.S. couldn't possibly be in all the places in the world today where the peace is needed to be kept. Our investment in U.N. peacekeeping is genuinely a bargain for us and a benefit for the whole world. These are the most broken places, but because of the UN, the world doesn't rely on the U.S. to try to solve them. The UN also provides food to 100 million people in 74 countries. It vaccinates over 40% of the world's children, saving 2 million lives a year. It assists over 34 million refugees and people fleeing from war, famine, persecution. It combats climate change, leads an effort to plant 1 billion trees a year. It mobilizes $7 billion in humanitarian aid after disasters. It fights poverty, helping 300 million rural people achieve better lives through the Millennium Development Goals. It aids international efforts by clearing landmines, and it promotes universal primary and secondary education. So to me, it's pretty obvious that we need the UN. And, you know, I think probably everybody in this room is not opposed to the role the UN plays, and you would be glad to know we poll once a year or sometimes twice a year the American public to find out what their view is. And Americans, by and large, are far ahead of their public officials in Washington in that they recognize that the UN is serving national interests, that they want to see the U.S. remain in a leadership position, that they want to see the U.S. continue to make its financial payments to support the UN. So we see numbers routinely like 80% supporting U.S. engagement in the UN, 75% supporting the payment of our peacekeeping dues, 70% supporting payment of our annual regular dues to support the UN, 95% supporting our engagement in an organization like the World Health Organization that leads to efforts to prevent the transport and migration of diseases around the world. Americans do get it, and that's really an important thing, that they understand it's not a perfect institution, but it's an essential one for all of our interests. Not only that, I think most Americans are aware that we are living in a world where our young people in particular really want to make a difference. And so I want to touch briefly on some ways that we've seen young people especially, but people across the spectrum, getting involved in issues that really matter to them and allow them to work with the United Nations. We run 13 different campaigns, ranging from ones on mobile health, using mobile telephones to improve health delivery and services, to energy, to providing clean cook stoves for women who are cooking around the world. But I want to touch on just three today. One is about a campaign that helps provide bed nets for countries in Africa where the mosquito bites at night and creates malaria, killing 3,000 people a day. Second, a campaign that helps adolescent girls stay in school, get access to health care, and prevent marriage before they're ready. And third, a campaign to vaccinate children around the world. So let me just tell you first about the Nothing But Nets campaign. This is a campaign that started 5 years ago when a Sports Illustrated reporter named Rick Riley, you probably, if you read Sports Illustrated, he had the back page editorial every week, and he was a guy who didn't know anything about malaria, like most of us, because malaria hasn't existed in this country for many, many years. And he read that, in fact, this is a major killer of children and pregnant women around the world, and he was shocked to hear that and kind of embarrassed that in all his time he'd never thought about it, known about it, or done anything about it. So he wrote a column called Nothing But Nets, and he said, you know, I've written about fish nets, I've written about hockey nets, I've written about basketball nets, I've written about Angelina Jolie's fishnet stockings, but I've never written about nets that could save a life, and I want to write about one today, and that's the malaria bed net. And he asked his readers to join him in sending $20 to send two bed nets to Africa, and we got $75,000 within a week, mostly from men, which is kind of unusual for donations, since I think women are the primary donors in a family. That led to our recognition that this was something that people understood. They understood that a bed net is real and tangible. You can see where it goes. You can see the impact it's having. And in the last 5 years, we've raised $35 million from 150,000 people, all of whom really get that simple notion and wanted to be part of a big solution. A lot of the people who've raised the money are young people who really love the idea that they could send the equivalent of two Starbucks coffees and make a difference in somebody's life. We also have partners in this campaign, ranging from the National Basketball Association to the United Methodist Church to Orkin Pest Control. So it's strange bedfellows or bednet fellows, but it works. And we think that's the model of philanthropy for the future. That led us in turn to thinking of another group that we thought needed some help, and that was adolescent girls. Girls are ignored in large parts of the world and in large parts of the development world. So when aid is provided to a country for women, 99% of that aid goes to women and 1% goes to girls. When aid in those countries is provided to adolescents, 99% of it goes to boys and not to girls. So girls have sort of been left out. And the more we looked at the facts, the more we realized that if you could invest in a girl, you'll probably invest in her family, and you know then you're investing in her community. So we began looking at what it would take to get access to educating a girl, keeping her in school longer, delaying marriage. One in seven girls is married before the age of 15 in the rest of the world. And when she marries that early, she has children too early, she can't stay in school, her life is changed forever. So we began thinking about who in our country would be motivated to help support adolescent girls around the world. And of course, it's adolescent girls. So we created a campaign called Girl Up, where adolescent girls learn about the life of a girl somewhere else in the world, share facts about it, send $5, and get engaged in saving girls. And the kind of work that we're doing around the world that the money that they're raising is going to are simple programs like keeping girls in school by providing school centers for them to go to, making sure there's sanitation in the schools, simple things like that. And a really innovative program in Ethiopia where we found that too many girls' fathers and mothers were simply agreeing to have them married because it was an economic decision they didn't really have much of a choice about. So we provided a goat to any family who kept their daughter in school. And boy, did that change everybody's opinion in a hurry. The fathers then began to see that their girls had even more economic value if they had the chance to go to school. So we think that's a great campaign and a great, again, opportunity for young people to be involved. Over 200,000 girls are now on our Facebook page, and they're making this their campaign. And we think this is another good example of ways that Americans want to be engaged. The final campaign I'll mention, and then I'd love to open it up for conversation and questions, is something we're calling Shot at Life. And this is a campaign we launched just last week in Atlanta, where the Centers for Disease Control are. And the notion is a very simple one, that in our country, we have the privilege and the right to vaccinate our children. We can make sure that they don't die from measles, they don't die from diarrhea, they don't die from polio, they don't die from pneumonia. These are killers in the rest of the world. And we know that mothers in this country want that for their children, and mothers in this country also want mothers around the world to have the same rights to have healthy children that they did. So we called the campaign Shot at Life. So it's to give all those children a shot at the tooth fairy and a shot at getting into school and a shot at having all the same things that our children have. So we think it's a great campaign. Again, it's a campaign that anybody can join. All these campaigns are on the UN Foundation website, as well as other information about the way the UN works and is accessible to you, even if you're here in Alaska. I want to end with just a few look-aheads, just as you're enjoying your long summer here, just some things that you might be aware of. One is just to watch what happens in the election as Americans talk about the UN in the campaign. I frankly don't think the UN is going to be a big issue in this campaign because jobs in the economy are, but sometimes when that happens, people tend to go insular and forget that it's important for us to be outwardly facing. I think here in Alaska, you are as outwardly facing as they come, so you're probably more attuned to that, but I'm hoping that we do see an election in which there isn't much misinformation about the UN and that we are still holding on to our need to be a global leader. I think we'll see in the next election, it's possible that the current U.S. ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, could be one of the candidates to replace Hillary Clinton in the State Department. I think that's really exciting because we do have in her a really strong leader who believes in using the UN fully and effectively for U.S. interests. Of course, I want to make sure you're watching for the Rio conference. That's a really important one to be keeping your eye on. What needs to come out of that is not only a strong energy policy, but also a strong recognition that social, economic, and environmental issues are no longer separate buckets, but actually very integrated. I know that's the way people here think, but we need to make sure that's the way the countries of the world come together and look at their future. Finally, there's a human rights election this fall that's important. It may not seem critical to our lives here, but human rights matter everywhere, and there are people who need to have their rights protected, even in every state in the union. The UN Human Rights Council is a very important body. We have a strong U.S. ambassador. She's from Silicon Valley, and has been a real leader in making sure that the Human Rights Council at the UN is thinking about modern issues like digital human rights, as well as more traditional human rights issues. The U.S. for many years was not a member, and when you're not a member, you don't have the ability to shape something. So it's great the U.S. decided just 3 years ago to rejoin the Human Rights Council. We are up for re-election again this fall. There are 5 countries in our regional group running for 3 seats. So hopefully the U.S. will win one of them. And finally, I want to say to all of you who are here, because you're here as members of or prospective members of the World Affairs Council, it's people like you that I think really are critical to keeping issues about Alaska's role, the U.S.'s role in the world, front and center. We don't have the luxury anymore of thinking of ourselves without thinking of ourselves in our global context. And I urge all of you to keep your participation up and your voices up, because we need people thinking about all this. At the UN, they say all the time, the UN is stronger when the U.S. is actively involved. And we say at the UN Foundation that the U.S. is stronger when it's also involved in leadership at the UN. And so my opportunity to come here and talk to you today is part of what I think is really critical, and I hope you will carry some of these ideas and issues home. And thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to some questions.
Well, Kathy, thank you for your very unique perspective on the UN Foundation and the good work that the UN is doing. I think a lot of us in the audience don't get to hear this kind of perspective, but for being here at the Alaska World Affairs Council. So here's my five-second pitch. For those of you who are not members yet of the World Affairs Council, we'd like to encourage your membership involvement because that's what helps us underwrite these unique speakers and presentations and perspectives that we're trying to bring here to the Anchorage community. So Carrie will have membership forms, or Eric can help you with membership forms at the back table if you're interested in giving us a hand. And before I turn the microphone back to Kathy here, I'd like to remind you that we are recording this for rebroadcast, so please wait until the microphone reaches you before you ask the question. And finally, just to remind you to plan to RSVP for our next session, which is on May 11th. It is our last speaker in the oil and gas series. It's Mr. Ed Chow, Shifting International Petroleum Landscape, What's It Mean to Us Here in Alaska. So please join us at our May 11th program. And with that, Kathy, please come on back and answer some questions that the audience might have for you.
Great, thanks.
Yep. Hello, thank you very much. As you know, we have a very rapidly changing Arctic with economic opportunity along with environmental and social risk, in particular to the indigenous peoples and their subsistence way of life. And in that sort of atmosphere, the Arctic Council is emerging as something of a likely governance body. And I was wondering whether the UN Foundation or the UN itself has much of a working relationship with the Arctic Council. And then a totally separate follow-up. As the father of a daughter who in a little over a year's time is going to head off to college and go into communications, and with your amazing communications resume, what advice would you have for her?
Great, great, great. And Ed Chow, by the way, who's your next speaker, is great. So that I'll put in a plug for next week's program. So, you know, I have to admit that coming to Alaska was educational for me, and so I didn't know as much about the Arctic Council or the Arctic Commission, either one, as I should have. As I mentioned, our president, Senator Wirth, is a major proponent of the Law of the Sea, and so he's obviously worked closely with the Arctic Commission. But I think this is an educational challenge for Alaska to help remind the rest of the country that we are an Arctic nation and not just that we have an Arctic state. And I think, you know, I was just telling Garrett that I just joined the East-West Center Board in Hawaii, and that kind of was opening my eyes to the challenges of the issues that the Pacific is facing. And, you know, I'm watching Hillary Clinton now really focus her energy and attention on the Pacific. I think the Pacific is becoming truly, you know, the place where so many of our U.S. interests are going to be carried out in the next century, and she's even talking about this as the Pacific century. So the shift in the country's mental leanings from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the traditional sources of oil and gas to the Arctic, I think there's a lot of education that has to take place. I don't know how best to tell you that the council should relate, and I've come away from this thinking, wow, the UN Foundation could learn more. We partner with the council in Washington on the work on the Law of the Sea, obviously, and we send out blasts to our membership, our email membership, which is about 350,000 people on a regular basis on the Law of the Sea, and I'm just thinking this is an opportunity for us to do even more. But I think there is a dialogue change that needs to happen, and it needs to happen not just up here but in Washington as well. So I think that's something that your delegation also needs to think about and take on, and obviously I'll take some of this back to Washington as well. For your daughter, wow, it's great, and I'm glad to hear she's going off to college. I see young people every day. We take about 20-something interns at the UN Foundation every year. We think it's, first of all, the best way to recruit, because if you see them early, you can grab them early and get hold of them. Plus, they're just such a breath of fresh air and new thinking for us. It's been instrumental in allowing us to be more creative in the way we've learned to use social media and other forms of communication, because we have these young people come in who say, you got to get with the program. It's hard sometimes to find a paid internship, but I can't stress how much I think doing some sort of internship while you're in school is a really important exercise, even if it's just unpaid, but you're doing it during your school term, or you can get some credit for it. That's really important to do. People do look for things like that on resumes today, and so many young people have access to internships that that I really, really recommend them. It's so competitive today for young people. And the other thing that I realize when I see young people's resumes is the major to me is less important than what they've done with their time. So it's if they've, because a lot of kids don't know what they're going into, and so the major may or may not be the right thing. But if they've used their time effectively to learn something different or to get involved in something on campus where they can show their passion, most employers are looking for that more than they are straight expertise. I saw one of these cooking show guys the other day saying, if you know how to cook, I can teach you how to do TV. Well, there are some things that you just need to, you need to bring your own passion to the table. And so I would encourage anyone who's young, thirdly, to get international expertise and experience. I think that today is almost essential on a young person's resume. And, doing something that's a little outside the normal is always a good thing. So I wish her well, and have her get involved in young in issues around adolescent girls. I think it's one of the hottest topics out there, and that we're seeing the need for young women leadership. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much for coming today. I guess you touched a little bit on some of the financial aspects of the United Nations, mentioning that I guess the U.S. pays 0.1% of tax receipts.
Of our tax dollar, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if other countries do the same. And I guess also, whether we are behind on dues, with the United States. And I guess, and then, kind of a secondary question is, how does the UN Foundation interact, and where is that point of interaction with the actual UN?
Oh, those are really good questions. Thanks. The number I gave you, the 0.1%, is the percent of our total tax dollar, which so much goes to national security, like 27% goes to national security, 32% goes to social services like Medicare, 0.1% goes to the UN. So we pay in dues every year close to $1.9 billion for peacekeeping. We pay $500 million for the regular dues, and we pay some rounding error for some of the other agencies. So it's about $2.4 billion a year. That is, we are the number one dues payer at the UN. The European Union is second, Japan is third. The biggest question is, how much do Russia and China pay? They're the other parts of the Security Council and the what they call the P5. China pays too small, in my view, given the growth of their economy over the past few years. There's a negotiation every 10 years on the dues assessments. So I think we'll probably see something that gets negotiated again. The last one was in 2004. So that's coming up. And it's an important issue. But the bulk of UN dues are paid by a handful, probably 20-something countries. The rest of the world are the recipient nations. I mean, that's the way it's always been set up. Where we're starting to see some differences is that, as I mentioned, countries that don't have the ability to make dues payments are providing peacekeeping troops. In the case of the polio campaign, which I think some of you probably know Rotary International, Rotary International has been, to me, just an unbelievable leader in world affairs, and they've raised over $600 million to help end polio. We now have a campaign going to get every country in the world to contribute to the final phase of the polio fight, and we're seeing countries as small as Mali in Africa putting in just a small amount to help. So lots of countries do help on particular disease issues. So the key issue to me on dues is that the U.S. as a good nation should never be a deadbeat. Good nations pay their bills on time and in full. For a number of years, the U.S. was not paying its dues. And in fact, when Ted Turner made his billion-dollar gift to the U.N., it was out of frustration that the U.S. was at that point $1 billion in arrears. We hadn't paid our dues, and the U.N. was beginning to be in serious trouble with making its own payments of bills. And when the U.S. doesn't pay its dues on time, other countries start wondering whether they should as well. So it's important. We either think it's a valuable interest and we want to support it, or we don't. But starving it isn't the answer. And so there have been a lot of efforts to reform the UN over the past few years. They're ongoing today. The best thing to do is to make sure that we're being tough at the same time that we're being supportive. So we are currently on time in our dues. We've been paying in full every year of the Obama administration. I think that was the second thing he did when he came into office, was to catch up the dues and make sure that the U.S. was paying on time, because he had an intention of using the UN effectively as a world leader. Where the UN Foundation intersects with the United Nations is really kind of interesting. We were created in an agreement with the Secretary General's office, so we have a direct relationship with whoever is the Secretary General. Because we were created under Kofi Annan, we had a phenomenal relationship with him, and in fact he has joined our board along with Mohamed Yunus of the Grameen Bank and other world leaders who are on our board. But we had a phenomenal relationship with him, but of course it happened under his leadership. We didn't know if that would happen when the new Secretary General came in, if he would say, well, that was that guy's deal. But in fact, I think the role we play in terms of U.S. support for the U.N., in terms of opening up public-private partnerships, has made this Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, also appreciate our role and relationship. So we work directly with his office. We also work directly with UNICEF, UNESCO, the U.N. Food Program, and others, because we do work directly with them on their missions. So we intersect at a number of different places. And finally, because we are the U.N.'s lobbyist in Washington, we work closely with their office in Washington. The UN can't lobby in any of its member states, so I don't frankly know what in this world they would be doing if we didn't exist, because in fact they need an advocate in Washington to help spread the word about them. We also run something called the UN Association, which is a membership organization created actually under Eleanor Roosevelt many, many years ago. It's a proud organization, but it was losing a little steam, and so we merged with it 2 years ago, and now we have chapters in about 130 cities around the world, some places where there are World Affairs Councils and some places where there aren't, and so it's another opportunity for U.S. citizens to get involved. Thanks. I think we had one here.
Most of the UN nations use the metric system, and we do not. It sets us apart. Can you tell us if that hurts us, and if so, how much? Thank you.
So could everybody hear that? That most other nations use the metric system, and we don't? Does that hurt us? I don't know. I have a feeling that there's some conversions that take place that we're sort of out of sync with the rest of the world, and you certainly see it when you travel that we're the only country that's arrogant enough to think our system is better than everybody else's. At the UN, the UN is in the metric system, but I don't know if that hurts us or not. I mean, are you in business? You might have a point of view on that. I don't really know. I think, the fact that the English language is so dominant is another issue. But when you're at the UN, everything is done in six languages, and there's a very careful effort not to make the English language so dominant that it overshadows all others. But I just don't know about the metric system. It's a good question.
Thank you very much for coming. Since the UN was founded, globalization is moving in leaps and bounds. The UN gives the impression of moving an inch or two at a time. And other organizations seem to be now more important internationally, like, say, the G20 or the G10 or G-string, whatever. So I'm wondering, you mentioned briefly the possibility of reform. Some of the problems with this bypassing of the UN is that marginal stakeholders' interests get left out. I'm wondering if you see any prospect for the assembly or any part of the UN being reorganized to be more effective in including some of these other international interests?
Boy, that's a great question. There's a whole speech to be done on that. So, when the G20 was formed several years ago, I think the UN, it was a wake-up call that this was a new organizational shift of power. It moved away from the G8, which, interestingly enough, I mean, I talk about an eclipse, the G8, which consisted of basically the eight largest countries and powers in the world. The G20 now is a more robust organization. But, the G20 is limited in its powers and perspective. It can't negotiate treaties. It can't create conventions. I think it's a really important force, and they've invited the UN Secretary General to be part of it. And that was a significant effort on the UN's part to get the UN Secretary General involved so that there would be a link between the issues and discussions at the G20 every year that are by and large economic, and what could be done at the UN in response. The UN is not an economic institution. It's much more of a political institution. It's an aid and humanitarian institution. Its greatest weakness, I think, is that it's the economic powers that were divided up when the IMF and the World Bank and the UN were all created went elsewhere. And yet we look to the UN as the body where all decisions get made. So this to me is the challenge with globalization, with the rise of the so-called middle-income countries, or the also called the BRICS, these countries like Brazil, India, China, Russia, that are growing economies and are no longer in need of aid and are, in fact, driving so much of the growth of the world. When we move to this next phase of the Millennium Development Goals, the goals were created in 2000 to help the world create a blueprint for eliminating poverty and global disease. When the goals were set in 2000, the world by and large existed in large donor countries like the U.S. and the Nordics and a few others, and countries that needed assistance. Now there are countries, and Brazil's a really good example, that can eliminate poverty in their own midst. And so learning how to, and in fact could in turn become donor countries. And our board just was in India, and watching India move from being both a place with the most poverty in the world because of the sheer numbers of people, but also the most rapid growth. I mean, their growth rate last year was 7%. This year it's 9%. The U.S. is 2%. We're seeing countries that are shifting their own ability to take charge of their resources, take charge of their economic plans, and the UN is having to adjust to how it helps them grow and helps them use the resources that it previously made available to it. So I think we're in for a really interesting 20-year shift where the UN will have to adjust its role to powers that now have expectations to be heard at the table and aren't still in the Security Council. The Security Council reform is grossly overdue, but no one can see the way toward a reform that has any of the five current members giving up their veto, starting with the U.S. There's a lot of different ideas out there for partial veto power, partial permanent membership. Right now, there's a rotating membership that goes along with the permanent membership. I think we're in for some really interesting changes. And the final thing I'd say, because I think the globalization issues are so significant with the questions of income disparity, and that the UN's role has always been to deal from the bottom up and to eliminate poverty, and so we've moved from the poverty line being less than a dollar a day to now being roughly less than $2.50 a day. That's been the UN's sweet spot. But other institutions, and frankly all of our nations, will have to deal with the fact that the bigger problem right now may be the income disparity and the income gap between the top and the bottom, which is so divisive in all countries and is, I think, undermining a lot of the leadership in many countries around the world. Thanks. Do you have a...
Gotta wait. Yeah, I just want to find out what happened to Mr. Ted Turner.
Oh, that's a good question. What happened to Ted Turner? So Ted is still the chairman of the UN Foundation. So Ted's a great story in so many ways. Ted's 72 years old. He has been chairman of our board and founder since 1998 when he created it. So it's so interesting that not only did he make a billion-dollar pledge, but he's actually delivered on $1 billion of a gift. So we've seen $850 million of Ted's gift. Our final tranche of $50 million will come to the UN Foundation in the year 2014. It's pretty remarkable to me in this day and age that somebody actually completes a pledge of that size and nature. Several years ago, when the stock market was in really good shape, I said to Ted, you know, maybe you should just go ahead and give us all the money right now, and we could try to put it in the stock market and grow it. And he said, not on your life. What if the market takes away my ability to provide the billionth dollar? I'm not going to let that happen. So he's had it in U.S. Treasuries since he lost some money when the AOL Time Warner merger took place. He's an active chairman in the best form of the word. For those of you who've worked with chairmen, you know they're a good chairman and a bad chairman. I'm sure Garrett's a great chairman. So Ted's the right kind of chairman. He's visionary. He sets the goals. He sets a high bar, and he's a bold, innovative guy. So boy, you better be bold and innovative in the way you work. But he's also cautious, and so he's the first to say, I never want to have a financial mistake. I never want to make an error. I never want to overstep our bounds with the United Nations. You know, our mission was not to go in and fix it, although many people wish we would. Our mission was to go in and support it. Give it the tools to improve, find the programs that were effective and give them support, give them assistance in streamlining. But our job is not to be the correctors of the UN, but to be the enablers of its best side. So he's probably the UN's biggest champion still. He, in addition to supporting us, he also supports something called the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which is aimed at eliminating and ending all nuclear weapons. And he's been a big proponent of the US and Russia getting rid of their stockpiles. He's a major conservationist, as you all probably know. He's the U.S.'s largest private landowner, owns a lot of land in Montana, Arizona, New Mexico, and outside the country. He owns a set of bison restaurants called Ted's Montana Grill, which came from his conservational streak that he owned a lot of land with a lot of bison, and you have to weed out the herd. And so he thought, I think I'll sell that bison for meals because it's good, healthy meat. So Ted's a great guy. He's a treasure to work with. He's an inspiration, and he challenges us every day to be the best we can. And his leading phrase is, "You can't always be right, but you can always be on time." So it's a good motto to live by. Thanks for asking about him.
Oh, yes, thank you. Hello. I was wondering if there are any plans to formalize the relationship and the role Alaska has with the UN, maybe more of a physical presence.
Yeah, it's a good question. I was asked that in Juneau, too. And I the UN isn't sort of present in any of our states except New York, where, of course, the Rockefellers gave this prize land on the East River to create the UN. You know, the UN was supposed to be put in Connecticut. Isn't that odd? And at the last minute, the Rockefellers had this land sitting there on the East River, and I think they thought, well, this would be a better use of it, and they donated it. And so actually the UN, the land the UN sits on in New York is not New York City territory. It doesn't fall under any of the rules in New York City, and we are just in the process of a major, major, major capital renovation of the building. It's that iconic, beautiful building. I know you've all seen pictures of it, but it was asbestos-filled. And so finally, there was an agreement because our government, as the host country, had to pay a bit of the extra part of doing the renovation, but every country in the UN has participated a little bit in that. So there's not a physical presence in many other states, and I don't frankly think there needs to be, but what there is a presence through the UN Association. There is a presence through many, many high schools that participate in the Model UN program. I don't know if any of you were part of that when you went to high school. I was, or if any of the young people here or your young people have participated in Model UN. It's a great high school and college organization that allows people to learn about the UN by basically role-playing the kinds of work that happens in the UN. You represent different countries and sort of experience what the issues are. I sort of think in this virtual world, that's probably a much better way for Alaska or any state to connect with the UN rather than a physical presence. But I urge you to look online because there is a lot. And actually, we helped the UN create its first mobile app this year. So you can actually get UN news on your phone if you are technologically proficient enough to get that kind of stuff. So we're trying to make the UN available wherever people are getting their information and news today. Thanks.
Well, again, Kathy, thank you for joining us today. And on behalf of the board of directors and the audience here, we'd like to just share with you a little gift from Alaska to take with you, and maybe you'll come back with your husband, John. All so again,
right,
a round of applause for Kathy for joining us today. And we want to encourage you, again, RSVPs for the May 11th program with Mr. Chow. So with that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.
Great presentation.
Well, thank you.